meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com. It's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, we're going to start out this evening with Pat Brown. Pat Brown's with the Pat Brown Criminal Profiling Agency. And we're here to talk about this case where young Brianna Dennison was killed. And it looks like Reno has a serial rapist slash killer on the loose. How difficult is this? This serial rapist slash killer has been leaving clues for the police. In fact, other women's underwear at crime scenes. And it's, is this BTK all over again? What is this? I thought I'd bring Pat on tonight to talk about it. Hi, Pat. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Dana.
Now, this is, it's a young college community, young, beautiful Brianna Dennison, another tragedy we see in the news. It's heart-wrenching to see these types of stories. The cops are obviously working on the case the best they can. Media organizations are covering it. All of a sudden, we've got the body, and we also have some DNA, but from another female that may or may not be dead or raped or whatever. We don't know. This is kind of scary. Your thoughts?
Well, I have to say that in this particular case, we actually have an easier case than almost all sexual homicides, because usually what will happen is you'll get in a neighborhood and a serial killer will jump out of the bushes and he'll kill a woman. He'll leave no DNA.
Yeah.
And then he'll disappear and there won't be another rape homicide for another year or two or three. And when that one happens, it might be 10 miles away, different jurisdiction, maybe a slightly different MO, there's no witnesses. Maybe he leaves DNA at that one, but they don't know who it belongs to, and they can't even link it to the other crime. So it just keeps quiet. Doesn't even go into the newspapers. They have no witnesses. They have absolutely no evidence. But in this crime, actually, there's a tremendous amount of evidence. So it makes life a little bit easier, hopefully, that they'll be able to catch this guy.
I use the BTK analogy, not that these cases are similar. However, this person, is this the start of a trail of evidence that the serial rapist slash killer will use to taunt the police? And why do these types of, criminals use that type of method? What is their reason for leaving that there? Is that a trophy? Like, here, I've done this too, by the way.
Well, there are some crimes when this is true, that they leave something, to leave their calling card, that they make a big point of it. They like to look in the newspaper and have it noticed, and then they like maybe getting a name that's attached to it. In this particular case, though, I don't think he was doing that, and I wouldn't want to even say that he was doing that and encourage the concept. Actually, most likely he simply just dropped it, and here's why. He left the body in and out of the way place. This was not a body left on the side of the road where immediately a passerby would see it and go, oh my God, look at this.
Yep.
It also wasn't a case where a woman was killed in her apartment. I think Danny Rollins did this one. And what he did was he cut the woman's head off and put it on a chest of drawers, staring at the door.
Right.
Now, when the police came, he got a big kick out of knowing that whoever opened that door would go, oh my God, because here's this woman staring at the head, staring at them. And then he knew they would take crime scene photos, so his cool artwork would go down in history. This is a person who's doing it on purpose. But in this particular case, the underwear is dropped in the woods along with a body who he probably hoped wouldn't be found. The body wouldn't be found for maybe weeks, maybe months in the snow. So I don't think he dropped it on purpose. I don't think he was taunting anybody. I think he simply is a slob because he's quite an idiot.
Yeah.
And this is the guy who leaves DNA every place.
Yeah,
he lets his face be seen. He lets his vehicle be seen. He's not the smartest guy in town.
No, that's for sure. And again, I'm going to use another analogy here, not the same type of case, but also goes back to a criminal who he himself wasn't very smart, but then again, a diabolical serial rapist and killer, Ted Bundy, who before the error of a lot of DNA was sloppy as far as what he did.
He was a blazing idiot. I mean, this is a guy, Ted Bundy, actually went up to the lake with his vehicle, his little Volkswagen, And he would walk up to women and say, "Hi, my name is Ted. Mm-hmm. Do you want to help me move my sailboat?" And then they would disappear. I mean, this is not the brightest person in town. And as a matter of fact, Ted's girlfriend and a couple other people actually told the police, "Hey, we know a guy named Ted. He drives a gold Volkswagen. He goes up to the lake. We think it's him." And and all that information was simply ignored.
Yeah, and that gets me to my preface of my next question was, here you have a young, pretty girl, other girls, college town. Are we looking for a profile of a young, handsome guy that's able to approach a young girl like this, gain her confidence, a la Bundy, and then go from bad to worse?
I don't think so. I mean, in Bundy's case, first of all, I never thought Bundy was very good-looking. That's just my thinking on it. He just looked like a normal fellow. And the trouble is, when you're walking along and a normal fellow comes up, you don't think, "Oh, my gosh, it's a serial killer." So if he says, "Can I help you with your groceries?" or, "Oh, gosh, I've locked myself out of my car. Do you have a hanger in your car?" I'm probably not going to run away from somebody who needs some help if he looks like a normal person.
Right.
You know, and Ted Bundy looked normal, not great, but normal. This man, on the other hand, doesn't seem like he is approaching women. He seems like he's abducting them. He's sneaking into their houses. So I'm not going to say he's not a normal-looking guy. He probably is a normal-looking guy. But that's just not his approach. He's not trying to use a clever ruse to get the women. He just seems to sneak up on them.
You know, I have a young daughter in college. I've had the experts on this program. I've done the lectures myself as far as preparing young people for going out on their own and that whole level of trust. But then just sometimes, like you say, this may be a case of abduction, kind of a smash and grab, for lack of a better term.
I call them bop and drops.
Well, you know, the exact same theory. But how do we prepare, young people, young girls in particular, be on the lookout for something like this? You hear stories now in Reno as far as pepper spray and taser sales going up and all this sort of stuff, and how they're
making money out there on that.
Well, exactly, and how the media has covered this, and we're certainly, and I'm not trying to put the fear into a community, but we're also trying to educate and have a community prepared.
Right, and the thing is, we shouldn't wait till we have a known serial killer out there, because these guys will pop out of the bushes and kill in the town, and it'll never be known there's a serial killer there until you're the person who gets attacked. As I say, there may be many years between killings, so we shouldn't let our guard down at any time, no matter where we are. But here's the number two thing. There are two things I think that women really need to do. One is stop getting drunk.
Yeah.
I mean, unfortunately, drinking like fish gets people so stupid they're not aware of their surroundings. They leave their friends behind and go walking off by themselves. They go home with guys they don't know or who they thought they knew. That's the number one danger for women, is drinking. And number two is probably living alone and going back and forth to their cars in the dark. When you have a stalker like this one, in this particular Reno killer, I do believe has been watching, trolling for women. He's observing where they're going and when they're going and when they're coming. And when he notices that these women are pretty much unattended and that they're probably good targets, that's when he goes after them.
Investigative criminal profiler Pat Brown is here, and we're talking about the serial rapist slash killer in Reno and the death of Brianna Dennison. When we look at the typical profile of an individual like this, most would think, you watch the movies, the guy in the shadows that has three teeth and his hair is all standing up on end, and at night he has the needle stuck in his arm and all that kind of sick, crazy stuff. The pictures all over the wall of his next victim, and sometimes that's true, sometimes that's TV. But these types of profiles and these types of individuals could be anywhere. And I think with young people, you mentioned alcohol and your mind thought there, but the internet is something else too. I'm not saying that's involved in this case, but how easy is it for these young girls with all these web pages and Facebooks and MySpaces and all this kind of stuff to be targeted?
Actually, I haven't seen that many serial killers actually go on the internet and target through that. You get more of the predator type. The sex predators, you're really into the sadistic stuff, and your child predators are going on there. But your bop and drop fellows, like we're talking about, probably don't need to waste their time on the internet doing that. They just simply troll around their town and grab somebody And like you said, they're not necessarily having all these photos in their house and all these creepy things going on. So the person who knows them, the girlfriend, the sister, the mother, the roommate, just sees him as he's a kind of weird fellow, but he's just like some guy. And he doesn't have anything particularly outstanding about him as far as any of these peculiar Hollywood fetishes going on. So that's one of the difficulties. And this guy, I think, really is this type. He's not exhibiting anything in his attacks that are particularly unusual or creative. Most serial killers aren't that creative. They just like to hit you over the head or strangle you and rape you and then leave you. That's it. That's all they do. There's no signature. There's nothing fancy about it. They just get their job done and go home and eat a hamburger.
You know, when we look at, and you make a good point, the profile of a lot of these individuals, look at the mall shootings here recently and school shootings, and there's always the question of the neighbor who lived next door to the shooter, and they always seem to say, well, he seemed like a quiet, normal guy.
I don't know about that, because in the case of the school shootings and the mall shootings, that actually have a lot of forewarnings on there, much more so than serial killers. Serial killers at least try to blend in. They're weird, but they kind of try to blend in and get along with people. The school shooters, they tend to be very obsessed with violence, and they tend to be hanging around on their internet playing violent games and watching violent videos. They tend to listen to a lot of death metal type music. They tend to wear those black coats because they're following a trend and a pattern. They're making themselves kind of the Jesse James of violent mass murders, shall we say. That they take on those personas. So actually, if you look at these guys, you can say, yeah, there was a lot of that going on. We just didn't know he was going to take it to this level, because we know other people who play violent video games and listen to death metal music, and they're not killers. But yet, that disconnect with society, the anger and hatred of society is there prior, and people do note it. They just never think it was going to get that out of hand.
How about the media coverage when you have cases like this? Some will say that there's that glorification and that the public's craving to see the stuff. And then there's the old, if it bleeds, if it leads line, that the media will go and cover it and not check and double check their sources before they go out and promote the story. How does that help or hinder the capture of a person like this?
Well, I think one of the biggest problems is that the police themselves need to get a methodology to approach the public. And one thing they need to do is only have one spokesperson for the police department. They need to lay out a very careful plan, a bullet point chart of information they want to give the public and the information they want to get from the public. And they need to reiterate that every single time they go out there in public. In other words, they don't want to just get somebody out there and start rambling on and talking about the case, because then they tend to say things that may or may not be helpful. They may egg the serial killer on. They may confuse everybody. Half the information is missing. So they really need to have one, usually fairly boring spokesperson. You don't want somebody with a great personality. You don't want the police chief coming out and saying, okay, I'm going to get you. You just wait. The serial killer goes, oh, cool, look, my nemesis. Not a good thing. So you want some really dull, they don't have to be dull in person and in private, but, dull when you get on the camera, spokesperson that says, we have a concern we need to bring to the public. We have a person out here who's been committing these crimes. Here is where he committed the crimes, A, B, C, D, and E, and here is what we need to know. You need to look into your, acquaintances and the people you work with and your family members and tell us whether you know a psychopath, and here's what a psychopath is like who's been in these areas, who has these type of attributes. Please give us a call. They need to do that every time and just drill it into the people's head so that they can start bringing suspects to the police.
So stay away from the dirty, hairy type of personality where
Absolutely. The serial killer does not need to be encouraged or egged on.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be made into some really cool guy. I mean, this guy is just a piece of garbage loser. That's all he is. He's nothing special. He's just a fat loser who decided to kill women. Okay, so that's all you could do, because you have nothing else going on in your life. Fine, you're a loser. Now we need to get you off the street. That's all we need to know about the guy. We don't need to turn him into something, give him a special name, and think he's just an amazing guy. He's not. This guy is an idiot.
Yeah, exactly.
An idiot who just, unfortunately, we don't know who he is yet.
Exactly, and that comes to my next question as far as the glorification of these types of individuals with the television, internet, media, and all that sort of stuff. In fact, there's this new television program that's out now called Dexter. Yeah.
God, do I hate that show.
I just can't believe it. And, the people buy into that. In fact, I've seen my own 20-year-old watching that show and telling me, Dad, isn't that a great show? I said, well, it's absolutely garbage. It's glorifying killing. How do we handle something like that?
That's a good question. I don't know how we can take this a peg down. I believe in the past we used to have more, when we had mystery stories like Agatha Christie, we were more focused on the puzzle. And we're more focused on the investigation, how the investigator's figuring things out. And that took away the glory from the killer and put the glory on the investigator. Now what we have is the glory, the investigator is usually not doing anything particularly intelligent. All they're doing is, you know, they're allowing the serial killer to take up the majority of the show doing incredible things, and then at some point there's some big showdown because they're getting chased by the serial killer, and they take them out at the last minute. So really what it's done is it's taken away from the puzzle and made it a personality issue, and that's what's carrying the shows. And unfortunately, when we had things like No Country for Old Men winning awards, which to me was nothing but a crappy gore film, and I like the Coen brothers until now.
Yeah.
But that one, again, took away from the sheriff. He didn't do anything except sit around saying he couldn't do anything and put all the glory glorification on the vicious killer.
You know, Hollywood has to come up with better ideas than this, but the Dexters, those types of shows, just garbage. But I want to get back a little bit to the type of personality, whether or not they're narcissistic, sociopathic, whatever, and look at a recent case. You and I have talked about it before, the Holloway investigation, and all of a sudden you get a Joran van der Sloot come out and this so-called hidden camera sting operation where he's bragging and talking about what he has done. The big question comes up now is, was it true? Wasn't it? Is he bragging? Isn't he bragging?
Yes, this is the new defense. The new defense is, I'm a psychopath and a pathological liar, so you can't believe anything I say.
Yeah, exactly. That's how crazy that is. But, you know, eventually, in a case like this, whether it's the Dennison case or other cases, these guys usually start bragging or talking about it, do they not?
No. Most of the time, they do not. That is a myth. The police will always come out and say, somebody out there knows something.
Yeah.
Actually, most of the time, nobody knows anything. A serial killer tends to kill and go slip back into his life, and all he might say is what anybody else in the country might say, which is, I wonder if they're going to catch that guy.
Yeah.
Or, boy, you know, police got their work cut out for them. But then we all say that. So there's nothing particularly unusual about that. So they don't start talking about it, and that's the problem. Most of them will take these things to their grave until they're caught. If they get caught, then they'll brag all over the place. But they don't want to go to jail, so they won't say anything. Now, in the case of Joran van der Sloot and Natalie Holloway, when he had the tape going there, that was a little bit unusual. First of all, he's not a serial killer.
Yeah.
I believe what happened, I believe it was a rape. I believe he killed her in the process of raping her. I believe he suffocated her in the sand because that probably was not what he expected when he shoved her down and sand, you know, conformed to her face and she couldn't breathe. He probably didn't know what was happening. Then he panicked and thought, what am I going to do? I killed this girl by accident.
Yep.
Called daddy. So, I mean, that's what I think happened. So I don't think he's a serial killer. I do think he's a psychopath.
Yep.
Because he is a pathological liar and a narcissistic little piece of garbage. But because of his narcissism and the fact he's so arrogant and thinks daddy can take care of everything and he's beaten the system,
yep.
That's probably why he was getting to be, he thought this guy was on his side, so he was talking to him. But actually, it's fairly unusual.
Let's go back to BTK for a minute. Something that goes on for years and years and years and years and years, and all of a sudden they start mailing in the license, driver's license of one of their victims, or they start to do that. Is that because they're missing it? They want to still stay involved somehow, or just let the authorities know that, hey, I'm still out here, and here's a little clue.
Right. Well, that's a complicated case. First of all, Dennis Rader is a serial killer. And he was a bored serial killer because he was getting older and hadn't done as much recently.
Exactly.
He wanted to brag a little bit because this case had come up. I do not believe Dennis Rader was the original BTK, and there was never any evidence to convict him of that. And you'll notice in the trial, he confessed the things that actually everybody knew who was following this particular story. Anybody who's worked the cases would know this. And there was actually zero DNA evidence to link him to all those other cases that the prosecution claimed. But the prosecution never showed a shred of their evidence, and I wrote about that, and I had the prosecutor write me back a very blistering email, and I said, well, then show the evidence, and she just disappeared. So there's no evidence. I believe that there was evidence a couple of crimes, but not the early ones. Dennis Rader, I believe, killed somebody after the death penalty, and they made him a deal. You confess to all the BTK crimes, and we won't give you the death penalty. We won't charge you with this one case. And he agreed to it because what a deal for him. He gets to be the original BTK. No evidence, and you can talk to a lot of investigators, and they'll say, yeah, we don't think Dennis Rader was the original guy either. But why did he do it? Because at that point he was over 60. was a problem. I think about 6, he wasn't doing much.
Yeah.
And I think he got a thrill out of it. He didn't think he was going to get caught, but he was an idiot, again.
Yeah.
He wasn't so smart. He sent out this, you know, had the CD from this, you know, which had information on it embedded from the church he was working at. So not too bright, but actually got himself nailed.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, his career as a dog catcher, I guess, wasn't as exciting as what he was doing. And that's interesting to hear you say that you don't think he's the original BTK. That's another interview for another time.
Another long story. Yes.
Yeah, I'll bet. Just before I let you go, though, Pat, I'm going to make you a detective now. Or the detectives from Reno come to you and say, how do we catch this guy? What kind of tip would you give them?
Well, the most important thing was, of course, getting out that victim's information, which, unfortunately, after the rape, this woman had been raped. She had given the description and didn't go out to the public, which might have prevented this crime of Vianna from happening.
Exactly.
It's really appalling to me. But okay, so somebody screwed up there. Now, the important thing, as I said, is to get out in public and give that bullet point chart. And most importantly, they rarely describe what a psychopath is. And so when people go to look for who they know who might have been near Brianna's, the house that Brianna was kidnapped from, who might have that van, who might have a shaved pubic area, or at least had one at one time,
yep,
who was around children because there was a baby shoe in the car, who had that kind of van that he was driving, and who also knew the dump site, because where she was dumped is just not some place you go if you're not familiar with the area. And a lot of times they dump really within a mile of where they work, or even sometimes within blocks of where they work or where they live, because they want to be comfortable in the area. So somebody has to know this particular man who knows these two areas of town. And also, here's another interesting thing. He's been striking from 3 in the morning to about 7.
Yep.
I'm wondering if the guy has an evening job, perhaps, or he gets off at 1 or 2 o'clock, perhaps a security guard, number one job of serial killers.
Mm-hmm.
And he also uses a sleeper hole, which is, again, kind of a security thing. So that people need to know they're looking for a psychopath, as a person who is a manipulative, pathologically lying, I'm always right, you're always wrong, grandiose thinking, he has no empathy for anybody. And that kind of person, if you know that man who knows the locations where Brianna was, where the dump site is, who might be busy in the evenings working a job, might be in security, might not be, has the van, the shaved pubic area, which could be for avoiding evidence falling, except he leaves his DNA, so I can't buy that. Maybe he just likes it, the new style.
Yep.
You know, these are the things they need to focus on, the community, and the police need to bring this up every time they talk. Put the bullet point chart out there, get it out to the community, because they have no idea who the guy is.
Absolutely.
They will not know who this guy is until somebody tells them.
Yeah, that shaved pubic area is a big thing. Give a plug. What are you on? Are you doing tonight? Are you on TV?
I just finished up Nancy Grace tonight. I'm off of TV for the evening, but if anybody's around, they can watch the rerun of it.
There you go. That's investigative criminal profiler Pat Brown from the Pat Brown Criminal Profiling Agency. You've got me interested in this BTK story, so we're going to have you back on again soon.
All right. Oh, by the way, my book is coming back on the market on April 1st in paperback. That's Killing for Sport, Inside the Minds of Serial Killers. Be back in the store.
Absolutely. And
in a cheaper form.
We can find that information on your website, patbrownprofiling.com.
That's right.
Absolutely. Thanks, Pat.
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye. Always controversial, says it like it is. Pat Brown from Pat Brown Criminal Profiling. We're going to be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio with Bob Peters, President of Morality and Media. We haven't had Bob on for a while, but we're going to have him come on and talk about Lindsay Lohan posing as Marilyn Monroe in the New York Magazine. And are you aware of the fact that there's been 70,000, believe it or not, 70,000 obscenity complaints sent into an organization called obscenitycrimes.org that have then been sent to the Justice Department in Washington, and you got to wonder what's been done about them. Well, not really much of anything. This is Dana Pretzer on The Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
It's The Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. And now back to the show.
Okay, we're back. I'm not sure if you've seen the pictures or heard about the story. You've probably heard about that, about Lindsay Lohan. Some call her a pop wreck. I have a couple of other names for her. She's a young lady that needs to get her life in order, that's for sure. But anyway, she posed nude for New York Magazine's February 25th issue in a recreation of Marilyn Monroe's legendary last nude photo shoot. Now, I've seen the pictures and part of the story, and I got to admit, this is... She is not Marilyn Monroe. Anyway, it's been a while since we've had Robert Peters, the president of the Morality in Media organization, to come on the show. We're going to talk about that and other things. Bob, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
I don't know. I have to admit, I shook my head when I saw the story and shook my head even more when I saw the pictures. And you have to wonder, because of the almost cult status that these young pop stars, the Britney Spears and the Lindsay Lohans and Paris Hiltons and blah, 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 all those types have, that all of a sudden you see this porn, you call it soft porn, I call it porn, in New York Magazine coming out. What's going on here?
Well, I got a call from a friend who alerted me to the display in the New York Magazine, and the next morning I picked it up, and I'll tell you, I was a bit on the shock side. I think if it wasn't the most explicit or envelope-pushing nudity display in a mainstream magazine that I've seen in my life, it had to come pretty close. In my opinion, it's right out of Playboy magazine, let's say in the 50s. There's a total topless nudity, and in fact I'll pull back a little bit. I think she goes beyond the 50s in Playboy, yeah, because she's totally nude, and in a couple of shots she's got a veil covering her front, and I had to stop myself from looking more carefully to see if I could see something behind the veil on the bottom part. But topless she is, and she must have had her breasts blown up with by a cement truck, because they're cantaloupe size. But at one level, I feel sorry for the Britney Spears.
I do too.
The Lohans and Paris Hiltons, and there's nothing that would make me happier to see one of these girls straighten up.
Yeah.
But I tell you, the bigger concern, of course, I don't know what is the bigger concern. Lindsay Lohan does this. The next thing you know, she'll be starring in a hardcore porn film. And, of course, the kids say, well, if she can do it,
yep,
and she gets ahead with this stuff, why shouldn't I do it?
Absolutely. And you say, I described the New York photo shoot as softcore porn for the same reason that people describe Playboy magazine's nude photo shoots as softcore porn. Men who subscribe to Playboy for the purpose of viewing naked women don't do so because of their appreciation for great art. So men who buy New York to see a naked Lindsay Lohan won't be doing so because of their appreciation for great art. And I think that's well said. In fact, this isn't great art. And, her career, in my opinion, I think she won the most Razzie Awards here last week for the worst picture. She's been in and out of rehab. One has to wonder what the thinking of New York Magazine was to bring this in and do this. It just takes society again and makes us all wonder what the heck's going on when we have to see work like this.
Well, I tell you, it sells individual magazines. I get my newspapers in the morning at a local store. I live in New York City, and he told me, said, this particular issue really sold. So it's a way to make a killing on a particular issue. But I think the trend in mainstream magazines is, allure. Somebody has been off and on harassing me for years, and one of the things this person has done, I think it's a he, has signed me up for magazines, gives subscriptions, whatever it is, and he's, one of the magazines he signed me up for was Allure, and once a year the magazine Allure does this nudity shoot, and I'll tell you, it comes close to the Lindsay Lohan, although I think she beat them. But there's a move. I don't know if the swimsuit magazine, the Sports Illustrated. I think by my definition, it's at least partially softcore pornography. I mean, and they are pushing the envelope. And of course, individual issues sell when they do this. But they stop and think. If half the magazines start doing this, the New York Post in August of last year started running half and full page ads of topless women. At first it's gonna get people's attention. It's gonna sell paper, gonna sell some magazines. But after a while, it's gonna drive customers like me away, and the people who think it's great, after a while that stuff is gonna lose its attraction. And basically, they're just going to become trashier and trashier and trashier. And instead of attracting people by the quality of their publications, they're going to have a significant audience that buys the paper or the magazine to look at nudity, and after a while that's going to wear off, so they're either going to have to push the envelope further or they're going to lose a lot of money in the long run.
So creative content goes out the window.
Yeah.
So you can sell money or sell magazines to make money. And one has to wonder what Lindsay Lohan was paid for this, because I can't see what this will do for her career except just flush it down the crapper even more.
Yeah, well, actually, one thing I don't understand, you know, Marilyn Monroe, to my memory is correct, she committed suicide. If she didn't commit suicide, she was living a reckless life so recklessly that it probably, you know, the line between suicide and the way she was living is so close you couldn't tell the difference. And, you know, I can't imagine why a young woman like Lindsay Lohan, with all of the problems she's had in life already, some of the similar ones to Marilyn Monroe, why in the name of God she would want to imitate Marilyn Monroe's tendency to take off her clothes in for the public, which she a tendency she exhibited as far back as the early 50s. I think she was the first fold out in Playboy magazine, if my memory is correct.
There's an election going on right now in the United States. Candidates are all over the place. They're talking. There's all sorts of things going on. I also see a story now about 70,000 obscenity complaints that have been recorded by an organization called obscenitycrimes.org. It's a website. Again, obscenitycrimes.org. They've got 70,000 citizen complaints. And the Justice Department and the FBI have forwarded these complaints, and what's been done? Nothing. Now, we're talking about, citizens whose homes and children are assaulted by internet obscenity. I've covered this, the internet, as far as different shows and programs, as far as stalking and child predators and pornography, you name it. It's just been wild. But you know what? We don't hear a lot as far as protecting our kids. We see this a little bit on the TV, but a lot of these political candidates, a lot of these governments, a lot of these powers to be, basically say nothing. You may hear the odd dumb comment come back and say, well, it's freedom of speech, but it's not, because we're not protecting the population from this garbage. Let's talk about that.
Well, the website is obscenitycrimes.org. The purpose of the website is to provide citizens with a means to report possible violations of adult obscenity laws. Most, probably many people don't know, there are federal laws that specifically prohibit the transmission of obscene material, broadly defined as hardcore pornography, on the internet. There's a website called Cyber Tip Line where citizens can report possible violations of child pornography laws. So Morality and Media figured, well, if a website can help in terms of combating child pornography, why couldn't a similar website help with battling against the adult pornography on the internet? So Morality and Media launched Obscenity Crimes in 2002, expecting to spend literally millions of dollars promoting the website. We ran out of money in 2002 after spending about $40,000, which to me is part of the success story of the website, because despite the fact we've had virtually no money to promote the website since 2002, we've generated 70,000 reports. And we discourage, even though part of me doesn't have a problem with it, but we discourage people from going out and looking for obscenity. You know, the website is intended primarily for people who come across, adults who come across the pornography unintentionally. You know, they're looking for one thing and they stumble into a porn site, or they get porn spam, or they discover that their kids have accessed pornography, or that pornography was sent to a computer porn spam ad, whatever it would be, where a child has access. So at one level, the website is intended to do what even some liberals will agree. They'll say, well, when it's consenting adults, the government shouldn't get involved. Well, this particular website is not aimed at consenting adults. It's
right.
aimed at adults who are looking for one thing, to find porn, or parents who discover their kids have gotten porn. So even liberals should support this website because it's not targeting consenting adults only related transactions. Not that I personally support that, but the website isn't focused on that. And you'd think the government would be happy to be getting complaints from citizens who stumble into pornography and or whose kids get into pornography. And yet, despite some wonderful things that the Justice Department has said about this project, it simply has not enforced the law. It's just that, I tell you, I'm beginning to use the word scandal to describe the Justice Department and FBI's record in this adult obscenity battle under the Bush administration, because so much more was expected to happen, and by everyone, including the pornography industry. And the fact after 8 years that so little has been accomplished in fighting this glut of adult pornography out there, most of which is accessible to children without proof of age and without having to spend a nickel, and that they've done so little, I tell you, it goes beyond being a rotten shame. It is literally getting into the scandalous, because somebody had to be doing something to have such a horrible record under an administration that I believe basically, you know, President Bush, I don't think is a member of the ACLU. I think he supports, at least in spirit, he supports enforcement of obscenity laws. And yet so little has been done under his administration.
Yeah, and that's the part that's sad. There's an article, a little bit I want to share with my my audience. It's called Confessions of a Child Porn Addict. It's from the Buffalo News from October 17th, 2007. We read, Clarence once enjoyed the adult pornography sites he viewed on the web. But after a while, the thrill was gone. So he started clicking on some of the ads that popped up on his computer screen above the naked men and women he was watching. He was seeing something new, young teenagers and even young children posing in the nude, having sex with each other or being molested by adults. At first, Clarence was appalled, but once the shock wore off, he couldn't get enough. Like thousands of other men through the United States, he was hooked. So I think there's that huge correlation between that adult obscenity and how it can lead to the child porn obscenity. Your comments?
Well, you know, that's one of the kind of inconsistencies with the Justice Department and the FBI, that they're spending almost all of their attention trying to combat sexual exploitation of children and ignoring the reality that certainly many predators use quote-unquote adult pornography, which includes the pseudo-child porn. It includes barely legal type porn where the girl may be 18, but she looks like she's 13, and she's portrayed as she's 13. I mean, you know, people who molest children may defy someone's common sense, but at least a significant number of these people also look at adult pornography. I mean, you'll see it in, you know, we monitor to some extent arrests where people are busted, both where there's an arrest for some sort of sexual assault and the word pornography appears in the story. You know, we do a search and we get these articles. And, on a regular basis, you'll find, and if you read the article, that the person who's been arrested for molesting or attempting to molest a child, they have child pornography in their possession, but they also have adult pornography. And, boy, I'll tell you, the regularity in which you read in these articles where the adult predator shows the child adult pornography, in the molestation process, it just happens all the time. And then the third way that this adult pornography is contributing to molestation of children and the explosion of child porn is that a lot of the guys that get caught in these stings, and I've talked to law enforcement people who have spent much of their life fighting sexual exploitation of children, and they agree with my kind of informed but not professional opinion that a lot of the guys that are getting caught in these things are not classic pedophiles.
No.
They're not the guys that something went wrong with them when they were growing up, and instead of being interested in girls in their own age, they were molesting girls when they were in high school, little girls. That's not the type. Most of these guys grew up normal, What got them goofed up is that at some place they got into pornography, they got hooked on it, and when you get hooked on pornography, anything becomes a possibility in terms of turning you on, including sadism and excrement and, of course, children. So a lot of these guys that are buying child pornography, they're out looking to have sex with a 13-year-old girl. If it weren't for being exposed to adult pornography, that would have never happened in their lives. And so, I mean, to me, if the government is concerned about preventing sexual exploitation of children, it also needs to be concerned about the explosion of this so-called adult pornography, which most people wouldn't probably know this, but it also is illegal if the government would simply enforce the laws.
Absolutely, and we're going to finish up with the statement that you've made. The Supreme Court has repeatedly held that the First Amendment does not protect obscenity, and opinion polls indicate that adult Americans support enforcement of federal obscenity laws. Hopefully, the next president of the United States will speak out forcefully against obscenity and nominate individuals to lead the Justice Department, FBI, and U.S. Attorney's offices will enforce obscenity laws effectively, and I think that was well said. Bob Peters from Morality and Media, thank you, sir. You're always welcome here.
Thanks for having me back. Have a good night.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah, if we can't protect our kids, then I don't know who we can protect. And the adult porn leads to the kiddie porn. That's just the way it goes. We're going to take a break. We're going to be back in a minute with former Secret Service agent, current private investigator Art Wood. Art emailed me today with an important message about the search for Natalie Holloway. Stay tuned. I don't want you to miss the next segment. We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, here's your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, we're back. In a recent interview with Beth Holloway, I brought up the term to her about justice, and justice can be served in many different forms. And I said, justice, in my opinion, may not be served in a court in Aruba, but justice certainly could be served by being able to locate her missing daughter, Natalie Holloway, and bring her home to Alabama, where she belongs. With an update on the search for Natalie Holloway, I have Art Wood, former Secret Service agent and current private investigator. Hi, Art. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Dana.
Now,
I appreciate you having me on. quite frankly, we have some bad news regarding the search for Natalie. As you may or may not know, John Silvetti and his company and the crew of the Persistence has been searching since before Christmas.
Right.
They have completed an underwater survey. The grid of all of the territory that they're going to search off the coast of Aruba. They have identified over 100 possible targets that could be Natalie on the ocean floor. They're trying to narrow that list to 30 or 40 more likely targets so that they can dive on them. However, John has informed us that they're totally out of money. If they can't come up with some donations within the next week to 10 days, they're going to be bringing the boat home. That doesn't mean we're going to give up. The targets are marked, and we're going to make every attempt to get the resources together to dive on these targets. However, Dave Holloway has at this rate, as we speak, he's been talking to various officials, and we're even asking the Arubans to chip in to help pay for the expenses. The cost of fuel and everything for the Persistence, you know, it's cost them over $1 million already. And without some charitable contributions, we're going to have to abandon the search at this time with... You know, without contributions, the Persistence is coming home. And I'm very, very disappointed that it would be a tragic end to this mission. We need to complete it. Even though the chances of finding Natalie may be dim, we will never know unless we dive on those targets.
You bring up a good point, Art, that the time, the effort since before Christmas, over $1 million of, you know, donated time. This is something that, you know, people have helped with, but they need to help some more. Tell us how my listeners or anyone that's out there with, you know, an organization or whatever that would like to help contribute to this, how can they?
Well, I'll tell them exactly how they can help, and I can tell them also that every dollar they donate would go toward the mission of completing that mission and to help find missing people. The Natalie Holloway Foundation was set up as a charitable organization to find missing people abroad, to help families who are searching for their loved ones or missing abroad. And quite frankly, I would request that your viewers, if they are willing to make a contribution toward this cause, to send a contribution to the Natalie Holloway Foundation, located at Post Office Box 4363, Meridian, Mississippi 39304, and I assure them that it's not like when you make a donation and you only 10% of it goes toward what you want it to.
Right.
There is no administrative costs or anything associated with the Natalie Holloway Foundation. I'm on the board of directors of the Natalie Holloway Foundation. I've served on that board for 2 years, and I do it for free. I am a volunteer. Everybody in the Natalie Holloway Foundation is a volunteer, and we don't take any payment. I wouldn't if I could.
You know, and how important is this? Again, Art, before I let you go, I'll have you give that address one more time. But if people are just tuning in late or missed what you just said, I want you to go over it one more time as far as what's been going on with the Persistence.
Well, the most important thing is that the Persistence has done something that nobody else could have done. They are a survey ship with the greatest technology in the world. They surveyed the entire coast off of Aruba and mapped it out in grids to the point where they were able to identify targets as small as a football on the bottom of the ocean. And they've identified over 100 targets that could possibly be Natalie. They're specifically thinking that she might be in a crab pot, so they are paying particular attention to targets that size. Targets that would hold a human body. And if they even reduce the over 100 targets, they're still going to have to dive on 40 or 50 targets. It costs a fortune now with the price of gasoline skyrocketing and diesel fuel skyrocketing to run that big ship. And they're out of money. It's just totally gone. The crew of the Persistence, the company that owns the boat, the captain, it's cost over $1 million to date, and it was all donated. You know, they were never paid a dime. But we need to bring some divers in, and we need to put fuel in that ship in order to complete this mission. And I think we could do it. He estimates in 2 weeks we could dive on all of the high priority targets and determine once and for all if Natalie's down there. That's what our hope is, that somebody will come forward, or many people will come forward with just some minor dollar donations to help us complete this mission. And they can send that donation to the Natalie Holloway Foundation, Post Office Box 4363, Meridian, Mississippi. That's Meridian, Mississippi, 39304. And that is a charitable organization. None of that money will go to anything but to complete this mission.
Just before I let you go, Art, and again, I do encourage my listeners to make their donations ASAP, because we want the search to continue. There was a press release came out today as far as some fabric that was found as part of this search being analyzed by the FBI crime lab in Virginia, I believe, not being the same as what Natalie was wearing the night she disappeared. Can you comment on that?
Well, you know, all I could say is that I'm unaware that the FBI crime lab examined any favor. If did that report come out on AP or?
Yeah, it's been all over the news wires today.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
I was unaware of it. Quite frankly, that's, you know, kind of disheartening. I would rather they found something, but quite frankly, we're looking for Natalie, and the chances are still there.
Yeah, and we all have to remember that the search for Natalie is one thing. The search for evidence to continue with the investigation is another thing, and maybe the two intertwine, but it's so important that this search continues, so I encourage you all to make your donations right away. Art Wood, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Dana.
You're always welcome.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Art Wood, and I didn't mean to sideswipe Art with that question, but it has been in the news media today about some clothing that's been found. I'm going to take a break, and we're going to be back here in a minute with Christopher Lyons. He's a co-founder of an organization called Cops Helping Cops, and I happened to be watching America's Most Wanted on Saturday and saw a segment where a bunch of cops, the Cops Helping Cops guys and gals, went down to New Orleans and helped remodel a house that was destroyed of a police sergeant in New Orleans. And I tell you what, it takes a lot to get this old-timer host choked up a little bit. But when I saw that segment, I thought, I've got to get somebody from that organization to come on and promote the good work that they do. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with Chris Lyons, from co-founder of who is the co-founder of Cops Helping Cops. And after that, there was a trade show in Boston over the weekend. And our crew of dedicated monkeys were there to reinforce the idea that Aruba may not be the safe place to go and travel. That's coming up here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
We're back with more of the Dana Pretzer Show on ScaredMonkeysRadio.com.
Okay, we're back. Did you happen to catch Saturday's America's Most Wanted? I'm sure most of you do. Like me, I'm a big fan of the show. I've had their correspondence on my program many times. But I happened to see a segment on there where a police sergeant in New Orleans, a hell of a nice guy, you know, he has a special needs son. He's dedicated to his job. But he also met up with Hurricane Katrina and Rita. His house was destroyed. He had to move his family out here. He's living in this shell of what used to be his house on a bunk. There's mold. There's all sorts of stuff. But then along comes Chris Lyons and the rest of the Cops Helping Cops crew. I've been a police officer now for 25 years, 3 months. I grew up in a family. My dad was a police officer for 37 years. It's no secret, I have a special fondness for cops. And when I saw that segment, it takes a lot to get this old fat sergeant to tear up. And I happened to tear up a little bit when I saw that. It was a special segment, and I'm really happy tonight to have Chris Lyons, co-founder of Cops Helping Cops, on with us to talk about that particular segment and their organization. Welcome, sir.
How you doing, Dana?
I'm doing great. You know, I have to admit, you know, we're all cops and we're supposed to be tough on the exterior, but you guys made me choke up a little bit. That was something special you did. Tell us about that particular segment, and then let's get into your organization.
Sergeant Petrano, we found him in back in December. We were actually down there helping a police officer and a firefighter get back into their house. And I went over to meet with Sergeant Petrano. He had actually signed up on our website for assistance, and just happened to be the next person in line. And when I went over, we were interviewing and talking to him and stuff like that. And I started going through the house, kind of just looking at what the house was going to require as far as, what it needed. And I was dumbfounded. I had another officer with me, and we walk into the back room and see this cot. And Sergeant Petrano was outside in the front of his house talking to one of the neighbors, and we're sitting there going, there's no way this guy's living in this house. It's just impossible. And we started talking to the guy and sat him down and just started kind of very delicately moving forward and asking him, because, as you know, most cops don't like to volunteer information about their personal life.
Exactly.
And lo and behold, we find out that he had been sleeping there and started to find out more about his personal life and situation. And it was unbelievable. We just could not believe that after all the time we have spent over the last 2 years, we thought we had seen it all.
Yeah.
Now here was this guy, and just we were dumbfounded. And the irony about all this is, as I talked to his fellow workers, his superior officers, they all had the same things to say about the guy, that he was the nicest guy,
yeah,
a lot of respect, represented this department while he's been on the job 25 years, but not one of them had a clue how he was living.
Yeah, yeah, it's
that's what made the whole thing that much more powerful, is that he, you know, this guy didn't complain about his situation. And when you hear of how he got to where he was, it was a very powerful story. He had actually, you know, he'd been married, had two kids. His wife, and he needed to obviously move out of New Orleans, so he got an insurance check, paid off the house that was destroyed, went and put a deposit down with the rest of the money on another house, so him and his wife and his kids had a safe place to live, but it was 2 hours out of New Orleans. And his wife got kind of upset with him for driving back and forth and commuting 2 hours plus his 12-hour shift. She didn't like being gone 16 hours a day. And he turned around, and she wanted him to leave. And he turned around and said, look, I can't leave the force. You know, I've been on there 25 years. He does the CSI, which is, you know, it's not something anybody can learn overnight.
Exactly.
He's like, my city needs me. You know, it's, you know, my fellow workers are depending on me. And for his dedication, his wife goes out and finds another man.
Yeah.
He gets to cheat on him over the next year. And when Sergeant Petrano finally finds out, she asks him to move out so the boyfriend can move in.
God.
And I turned to him and I said, so you started living here? And he said, no, I originally got a $500 a month apartment. Mm-hmm. So I said, oh, you have an apartment? He goes, well, not anymore. And I said, well, what happened to it? He goes, I couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
I said, wait a minute, you're a sergeant with the NOPD. How could you not afford a $500 a month apartment? Mm-hmm. And he looked down at the ground and I said, are you still paying the mortgage on the other house? And he goes, well, not just the mortgage. He says, I'm paying the cable bill, the telephone bill, the cell phone bill, the electric, the oil, the heat. And yeah, he went on with a list. And I went,
wow.
Why? And he goes, well, I have two kids. And I said, well, you know, I don't want to get in your business, but take the kids and, you know, move on.
Yep.
And he said, I can't do that. One of my kids is handicapped.
Yeah.
I need attention 24 hours a day. And, you know, be it what my wife is treating me like, she still takes care of my kids. And to me, that's all that matters. And at that point, I realized this guy would rather live like an animal,
yep,
than a human being, as long as his kids were well taken care of. And that right there told me everything I needed to know about the guy. But you take all that and compile it and then add the holidays. We were a week and a half out of Christmas, and we realized we had a very bad situation, you know, with his mental state and everything else. And I don't want to say anything bad about the guy, but I didn't want to take that chance.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the first thing I did is I literally started walking around, going to companies and everything else. And I raised 4 months, actually, I'm sorry, 6 months rent, and found him an apartment, so that going through the holidays, he was out of the house.
Right.
But our next problem became to try to get a trip together as fast as possible. And the tough part about all this was, we had been being funded by the New Orleans Police and Justice Foundation for the entire 2 years we've been going. Right as I met Jay, we got a phone call and I had to go down for a meeting. The fund we had been drawing from had ran out.
Jeez.
Now there was no more funding. And we had no idea what we were going to do for this next trip. So the whole thing became a very tough situation for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, when you look at dedication, this sergeant and his personal life, we don't see a lot of good stories in the media about cops. We see all the negative stuff. It drives me crazy. I cover the good stories here on my program, and this is one of the good stories. But all of a sudden now, you got a guy that's going bankrupt to pay for his family. His wife's cheating on him. He's living in a mold-infested shell. You guys are trying to help. The funds are running out. How did you get this going, and how did America's Most Wanted get involved? And by the way, America's Most Wanted, John Walsh, John Lieberman, all those guys, Ed Miller, you name it, class acts all the way.
Oh, they were. John Walsh, I had never met him before, and the entire crew, I will never be able to say enough of how nice they have all been. And John Walsh, what an amazing guy.
Yeah.
I'll get into the other stuff in a second, but one thing I want to say about John Walsh is after we were done filming and the cameras were off, he came up to us and he says, "I got to tell you," and this is a point of view I had never really thought of. He said, "You know, every week I go home and it's kind of depressing. I know that there is somebody out there that just killed somebody,
yeah.
and, you know, or raped somebody, and all these murderers, and I'm profiling them, and every day I got to hear the stories and then narrate them about what somebody's done." He said, "This is one of the very few times I'm going to go home and I'm going to be really happy."
Right.
Because this was an awesome story, and I had never thought about that, but he was a wonderful person. The way they came out and how the whole trip got funded, that's kind of an interesting story. We had sent out letters because we realized we needed to get some attention and some help and get the talent down there to help out. So we sent out a letter, and somehow one of the guys from the Michigan Sheriff's Association had a contact at America's Most Wanted and got this to them. They had a discussion, wanted to know more about it. And I posted a video, which you can now see on our website, and it shows Jay's current living conditions.
Yep.
And with that, they now wanted to come on board. The problem was funding. And there's an undersheriff who's my partner. His name is David Fowler. He's the undersheriff of Osceola County, Michigan. He and myself decided we had to do something because we didn't like the guy living the way he was, and we weren't going to put him in this nice apartment and then have him move back.
Yeah, exactly.
So we figured, well, we're going to take a chance and pray we can get enough donations afterwards. We're going to take care of business now. And he and I took all of our credit cards, and thank God mine were all empty and so were his, and literally paid for the trip on credit cards.
Yeah.
So that this guy, you know, we could deliver what we promised. And we also knew that the exposure from America's Most Wanted would also help and get the word out, because it's not just about us. It's they need attention down there. You know, the world, I worked 9/11, and everybody was always worried about never forget, never give up.
Right.
And the problem is, you know, if you leave lower Manhattan and you go to Long Island or Midtown Manhattan, there's no more 9/11 unless you talk about it.
Exactly.
It's normal.
Yep.
You, in New Orleans, go 30, 40 miles and get off the highway, there's still Hurricane Katrina.
Yep.
Everything they know, their neighbors, their friends, everything you would use as a support system is gone. And these guys are living in an area which is just, it's amazing that people are suffering like this. And meanwhile, we're worried about what's going on in third world countries, spending billions of dollars a day. And we need to take care of our own first. Then we can worry about the rest of the world.
And that's how important it is. And there's that unique bond with police officers. You know, some people criticize it. I grew up with it. I live it, and I've done it myself now for over 25 years. And, you know, we stick together, men and women that wear the badge. And it was so heartwarming to see this story and to see the look on his face when you know, the whole thing with the trailer, and even move the trailer and bring him into the house. But I want to hear a little bit about Cops Helping Cops, your organization. How is it made up, and your website, and can people donate to it? Because that's so important.
Yes. Well, Cops Helping Cops was started out of a need for what we saw. Under Sheriff Fowler and myself, we actually met during the Space Shuttle Recovery Team, which one day we hope to meet the families of those seven astronauts and thank them. Not thank them, but let them know that their loved ones didn't die in vain, because that's how this ultimately started. I met David. We started doing search and rescue from that moment forward. We bonded a friendship and grew. We both ended up down at Hurricane Katrina and started doing assistance down there and helping out search and rescue. We were on the boat. And then I think it was a couple of months later, I started talking. You know, they were having problems with the telephones down there. We finally got through to one of the police departments down there. And it was somebody I'd worked with, and I started talking to her and asked her how she was doing. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever done any type of critical incident debriefing, sometimes it just takes that one line or one right question,
yep.
and boom, you'll get into somebody.
Yep.
And I just happened to ask, is there anything that I can send you?
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I said that, she broke down crying, and she said, toilet paper. And I went, what? What do you mean, toilet paper, for the precinct or for yourself? And she went, both.
Yeah.
I said, is there anything else you need? And she goes, yeah, soap, paper towels. And I went, that's impossible. This, and, you know, I didn't say this to her. I'm going, it can't be this bad. So we turned around, and I called David up about 2 in the morning, and I said, look, this is what's going on down there. I can't believe it. And he and I said, this place still sounds like it needs rescuing. The two of us bought a plane ticket. We were down there 2 days later.
Mm-hmm.
When we arrived, we were shocked because one of the things she had said to me was, if you can believe it, it's actually worse now than when you were down here. And she was right. It was. I couldn't believe what I saw. So we started talking to a lot of the police officers and started seeing what they were going through. And then, you know, everybody was saying that the biggest problem was that there were these groups that were promising to come down and help out, and they weren't. Or money was being diverted to them, and then they'd take off with it. So it became a huge problem of, you know, how to help these people. And when you went and saw what they were, you know, they're living in a little trailer with 4 kids, and they've been this way for 6 months, and you're going, how can anybody live like this?
Yeah.
So David and myself sat down over supper while we were in New Orleans and decided, you know what? What happens when you've got an emergency? You have people that do search and rescue and cops and firemen, and that's what they do. They come down and they help. We need to let them know that there's still a need, and these people still need help. So we came up with the name of Cops Helping Cops, but it's not just about cops helping cops. It's about firemen and police officers and EMTs and search and rescue going down and helping their fellow brothers and sisters and getting them the help that they need. And the reason that a lot of them suffered, which took us a while to figure out why the police department was suffering and the fire department was suffering so much more than the average person, is they were more worried about taking care of everybody else.
Exactly.
Instead of themselves.
Yep.
So we, you know, and by that point, you know, trying to get trailers and place to live and the assistance they needed, it wasn't there. So they were really suffering. And they had, like, the road home where they, you know, they put in an application and thought they were going to get some type of funding. We talked to one officer. They gave them $78 to build a whole house with.
God.
We talked to other people that they had just flat out got denied. And, you know, one guy's like, I've got perfect credit. I don't know what more I need to get assistance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then you had the insurance companies not wanting to pay up. And it was just really tough to see that they were going through all this. And then, you know, we stepped in. And right out of the gate, our very first officer, we had met him before, but he didn't really believe we were coming to help. It was kind of like you were Santa Claus. You had all the gifts, but people didn't want to let you in because they didn't trust you.
Right.
And this guy hadn't gone shopping. I mean, we're on the tarmac at JFK Airport getting ready to take off with a bunch of officers to come down on our very first trip. And he hadn't gone shopping for a stitch of stuff yet and goes to me, oh, you mean you're really coming? I went, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And to kind of give you an example that worked out really well, him and his wife were on their way to divorce court and had separated. He was living in the trailer, had gotten his wife a house, so her and her kids were safe. And, you know, that's what he was going to live like. We stepped in. She came down. We started talking to both of them. Ultimately, they ripped up their divorce papers, and today they're still together and are very happily married. And as a matter of fact, this officer now comes out and helps us on other homes. And that's been the trend. We've been able to get a lot of these families back together. So it's been a really neat experience, because we're not just repairing a house, we're repairing a family and getting them back together. And we're helping an officer with their mental health and getting them the help all the way around.
And that's so important. That's so important, Chris, and you guys, we're just about out of time here, but you guys and gals are doing something, you know, you'll understand, I'll understand, but the listeners may not understand that, you know, cops, what do we do all day, all night? We listen to other people's problems, we try and help with other people's problems, but who comes and asks us our problems? And we're so, you know, the persona of wanting to get help or asking for help is so tough because we've got that, you know, that image. And when you have an organization like yours that can go down and not only help with the home and rebuilding the physical structure, but also helping with the mental structure, again, it just warms my heart to see and hear stories like that. How important is it? Share with us your website, and can people at that website make donations to help with your organization?
Absolutely, and they are very much needed right now. This last trip kind of buried us pretty hard, and we've had quite an outpouring of pleas for help from other people that are, we knew this was going to happen, we're going to come out of the woodwork, and now we'll go, wait, maybe there is still hope, maybe these people can help me. The name of the website is www.copshelpingcops.com. And you can make donations. We take everything from PayPal. You can mail a check. There's addresses there. You can see videos of what the officer was living like. And then you can actually see a video we got from America's Most Wanted that'll actually show you kind of a bridge version of the trip and like how his house turned out, which turned out absolutely, it was amazing.
Yes.
And one thing you guys got to understand is when you watch this video of this officer on the AMW clip, he's smiling.
Yep.
He had not smiled the entire time I had met him those first 2 months.
Yep.
And here's a guy that completely transformed and is now, he's on top of the world. And that meant, that told us we did everything right. I mean, I can't say enough about him. And he's a wonderful guy.
Yeah. Well, you know, God bless you and your organization, and you're welcome on my program anytime. And if I can help with any PR stuff, just let me know.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that, Dana.
That's Christopher Lyons, co-founder of Cops Helping Cops. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye. Yeah. And, you know, again, it takes a lot to get me, you know, some of these shows, you know, they're reno shows and come and help. I usually kind of turn away from them, but when I saw that segment on America's Most Wanted, I just thought that was fantastic, because Cops Helping Cops, I'm going to cover that story and I'm going to talk about it. Okay, I'm going to open up the phone line, 1-306-842-7884, 306-842-7884, and call in and we can talk about anything you want. I'm hoping to get an update from one of the participants that went to the recent travel show, I guess that's what it was called, in Boston. And I've covered this segment on my program several times before, where a group of individuals go and speak I guess use the term protest to educate those at these shows that Aruba may not be the safe place to go to. If they can't protect Natalie Holloway, will they be able to protect you? Hi, caller. You're on the air.
Hey, Dan. It's Observer from Scared Monkeys. How you doing?
I'm doing good. And you were one of the monkeys in Boston, or should I use my Baston accent? Baston. I didn't think a Canadian from Saskatchewan could say Pakyaka in the Havid Yad, but anyway. we've covered this or done several segments on these types of stories, these travel shows, and maybe that's not the right term for it, but tell us about what happened in Boston at the travel show and your effort to educate the public about Aruba.
You betcha. Well, the travel show was this Saturday and Sunday in Boston, Massachusetts. This is the big event for the ATA, or the Aruban Tourism Authority. They have, they're a major sponsor in Boston. This is their bread and butter, along with New York. They spend well into the six figures with the show. They have a crew of at least a dozen. We attended this event last year, and they were well prepared for us this time. Between the security, Port Authority, the police, we were harassed at the very beginning till the very end. And, a lot of interesting things happened, I think, with the events that happened the last couple weeks, as far as Dateline.
Right.
The 2020 with Vandersloot's admissions or confessions, I think it was perfect timing.
No.
And I think it was a humongous blow to the Aruban Tourism Authority at their show here. Not only are people more educated, but they're finally aware of what the Aruban government is doing to Natalie Holloway and her family.
I'm not sure if you heard the segment or not with Art Wood. That's basically the boat people, not boat people, the people on the Persistence need money, $1 million, and it's time to get some money to help them. And Art mentioned it, and unless I'm wrong, he said that they're even going to go to the Aruban government and ask for some funding. And wouldn't it be nice for the Aruban government to finally step up and help with this? But your message to the people that see that, you at these travel shows, you and the other people that go there, what kind of comments were you getting from the John Q. public that were going in and out of the show?
You know, it was a variety of comments, Dana. A lot of it was absolute disgust. We had a monkey that traveled there named CJ, and she had a beautiful sign that you may have seen on the website, and shows different emotions that Beth was giving, crying. And the Bostonians, they're upset. They're not happy about it. They realize from the recent interviews what the Arubans have done to the family. A lot of people told us we'll never, ever go there. What really moved me was the people that came up to us and actually shook our hands and said, thank you for being in, for coming here on behalf of the family. And, I just wanted to thank everybody that was a part of this and gave us support on the Scared Monkeys blog and on the front page. People that donated, we were on a shoestring budget in 30-degree weather. It was a very small group of us, and we were taking on a very large organization that spent, hundreds of thousands of dollars for the show. But the message is pretty clear in Boston. They're fed up, and I think that the ETA is going to see a big decline in their tourism, especially from the New England area. And it's not only the voice that we showed for Natalie in Boston, but it's also the recent media that's been on between Greta and Bill O'Reilly and Dateline in 2020.
Now, there's you're doing this on several different fronts. There's another trade show coming up in New York, I believe.
There is. There's a good-sized trade show next weekend in New York, and it is a great opportunity for anybody that wants to get on and do something for Natalie. I can promise you that this is something that you'll never forget. And it's well worth every second that you spend for Natalie. It's a one-day event. They're going out there next Saturday. It is an enormously large show in New York. Aruba is not the major sponsor in New York, however, they do have a jumbo-sized booth.
And again, your message will be as far as, I apologize, I don't have the pictures in front of me right now, something, no justice for Natalie, no tourism for Aruba, or something like that?
Yes, sir. That is one of the messages that we're spreading. You can't forget about what happened to Natalie and the family. That's something that Aruba was hoping everybody would forget back in June 2005. Unfortunately, it didn't work that way, and it's never going to go away until they finally give that girl an honest investigation and bring justice to Natalie.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Dana.
Take care. Bye-bye. All right, that's the show for tonight, and I remind you all to check out the website at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you'll be able to hear a podcast of this program, listen to other programs in the, I think they go back even 2 years or so, and my daily commentary, and of course the creme de la creme of blogs is scaredmonkeys.com. My name's Dana Pretzer. Hope you enjoyed the show tonight, and we'll see you again real soon here on the Dana Pretzer Show. Good night.
Been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.